I had a little trouble beginning the pastoral prayer because I had sat and watched Bob Scott in silhouette against the window and thought about 27 years of friendship, the times we have laughed together and cried together, the fact that he is more responsible than anyone else in Wichita for my being here. It's an experience always for me to hear him sing. That's a little too heavy, so I need to share with you a bumper sticker. I can't resist bumper stickers, and if they're difficult to read, I have to get close enough to read them. And so the other day I was close enough to read one, and this is what it said. Please, not so close. I hardly know you. I was talking the other night with a friend who told me how he decided once to spend a certain amount of time each evening reading the Bible to his children. He ran into deep trouble pretty quickly in the Old Testament, which you will understand if you have read the Old Testament. So he moved to the New, where he thought surely there would be plenty of inspirational passages for his children. But he had problems there too, with some things that he wasn't ready for his children to hear yet, or which were too difficult for them, or which simply no longer had any relevance to modern life. I mention it only to say that when a minister decides to do expository preaching, in which he simply reads from the Bible and comments on what he has read, he has some of those same difficulties. He has to be rather selective, for one thing. As my friend found out, to his surprise, sizable chunks of the Bible are simply not relevant. When Paul talks about whether people should eat meat which has been sacrificed to idols, or discusses the young man who married his father's wife, or goes on at great length about the religious significance of circumcision, it's pretty hard to convince audiences in 1987 that they are getting guidance for modern life. But near the end of Paul's letter to the Christians at Rome, there is a section made up of comments just as relevant today as when Paul first wrote them. So I invite you now to hear them and what they mean to some of us when we read them, so that perhaps the apostle can speak as forcefully to you as he did once to a handful of brand new Christians in the world's capital. With your eyes wide open to the mercies of God, I beg you, my friends, as an act of intelligent worship, to offer him your bodies as a living sacrifice. Now, if you ask people to open their eyes, there must be some kind of preventable blindness. And it's obvious what that is for Paul. It's the spirit of ingratitude, of taking things for granted, of not being thankful. And that defect of character may be more frequent now than it used to be. I saw last week a sermon preached in the Massachusetts colony in 1663 to some of our congregational ancestors by a minister who spoke their gratitude for them. Lord, thou hast been a gracious God and exceeding good unto thy servants. We live in a more comfortable and plentiful manner than ever we did expect. The eyes of his people were open to the mercies of God. And although in this case they were expressing surprise at their unexpected prosperity in this country, material blessings, beyond a certain point, do not seem to have much to do with how grateful people are. I know some with more than they will ever need financially who complain all the time about how bad the world is and have constant nightmares about thieves and the stock market so that they cannot be said to be happy. I've known others with not much who could find trust and loyalty and the joys of friendship and the challenge of good and great causes, and who were excited and happy to be blessed with such things. It really does seem to be a matter of attitude. You see some things only if you have a mind to see them. Elizabeth Peabody, a famous teacher around Boston in the 19th century, was asked one day how she happened to run right smack into a tree on the Boston Common. She said, "I saw it, but I did not realize it." And I understand that because it happened to me once years ago. It has happened frequently, I'm sure, in small ways. It happened once years ago in a rather memorable way. I drove out of a supermarket parking lot after looking carefully up and down the street. Mr. Scott will remember this because he is my insurance agent. And I had no sooner gotten into the road than I was struck broadside by a motorcycle. I must have seen it, but with my eyes conditioned to look for cars, the policeman explained to me, I probably had looked at it without realizing it. And as I thought about it later, I saw it as a small parable of the way we live. We see things without realizing them. If you've ever gone back to a place where you lived once, you know what I mean. Having come back with fresh vision, your eyes wide open instead of being closed by familiarity, you are amazed at what you had seen but not realized. Lynette Woodard, our gift to the Harlem Globetrotters, was back home in Wichita not long ago to visit North High. She said, "I didn't remember the halls this way. They seem small. But when I first came here as a student, they were huge, and they terrified me." Well, the halls hadn't changed. She had. We see with more than just the machinery of cornea and retina. We see out of emotion and habit. So Paul says, if you never see any good in life to be grateful for, if the mercies of God are obscured, it may be that you have developed a mindset that won't let you realize those blessings even while they are happening to you. Gratitude is important to Paul because it has to come first before he can get his friends to do something else he wants them to do very much. With your eyes wide open to the mercies of God, I beg you as an act of intelligent worship to make your very bodies a living sacrifice. The people to whom he wrote knew all about putting bulls and goats and lambs on the altar. But this was a new idea. They were being asked to put their own living selves before God as an offering so that they belonged to Him. It's an amazing request. And except for occasional people like Kagawa and Schweitzer and Father Damien in the leper colony and Mother Teresa in Calcutta, it hasn't been taken very seriously by most of us. But we still owe it to ourselves to know exactly what Christianity asks, even if we are not up to responding fully. If nothing else, it keeps us from the trap of supposing Christianity is an easy and comfortable thing, something on the order of our own country club. It isn't. Paul goes on then to express one of the most enduring challenges in the whole letter. Don't let the world around you squeeze you into its own mold, but let God remold your minds from within so that you may prove in practice that the plan of God for your life is good. Don't let the world squeeze you into its own mold. But oh, how it tries. The single most persistent threat to a really fine life is the terrific counter-pressure of the environment in which it must be lived. No sudden thrusts, usually just a slow, almost imperceptible squeezing until we have been shaped into the dominant intellectual and social forms around us. Anyone who's ever read it, I suppose, remembers Thoreau's famous line about marching to the sound of a different drummer. It was not an easy thing to do in his time. It may be even harder now, mainly because we know instantly what other people are doing and saying. Newspapers, radio, television, all of them combine to inform us about the very latest definitions of success, the newest fashions, the most current expressions. We are simply able to conform more quickly and easily than ever before. I'm just back from a long trip with extended family, one of the extensions being a 16-year-old girl. Conformity at 16 is sacred. You wear the things other 16-year-olds are wearing. If it's boys' boxer shorts, which some of us always thought were fashion failures anyway, and were grateful they were hidden. If boys' boxer shorts are the latest fad for teenage girls, then you bring them out of their former blessed obscurity and wear them for public view. If everybody else's favorite judgment of most things in the world is that they are gross, then that's the word you use 100 times a day. Put a little ketchup on your eggs and bacon, and she wrinkles her nose in exquisite disgust. Gross. Grandfather, gross. Tell her you really like this bathing suit you've had for a couple of years, and she tries to combine both love and pity in that one ubiquitous word, gross. Grandmother, gross. But how could I say much to her about conformity when every small town we entered looked pretty much like every other small town in America, because economic and social pressures had worked to mold them all alike. We're way up in the mountains of Vermont and New Hampshire, off the interstate, poking along on the blue highways, looking eagerly for something different. And over we see Burger King and Wendy's and Pizza Hut and McDonald's. And for quick, confused moments, we wonder if we ever left home. But that isn't the kind of conformity Paul was worried about. He wanted these new Christians in a non-Christian world to feel free to shape their lives in ways that were not traditional. So he encouraged them to resist the pressure to be like everybody else on the block. It must have been hard for them in those times of slow change, but it has not gotten much easier. I saw during my reading for this sermon a letter so amazing I had trouble believing it was actually written, but it was. A physician, whose name is irrelevant, wrote to his son, who was a student at Kent State during those days of campus unrest, which some of you will remember. He said in the letter, avoid revolution or expect to get shot. Mother and I will grieve, but we will gladly buy a dinner for the National Guardsman who shot you. Conform to the prevailing mores of society or die. No hint anywhere that the values of a certain year might need to be questioned. Just conform. I don't have to explain the irony in that. But of course I will, having preached too long. The irony is that this father and most of his friends honor live conformists at the same time they are honoring dead nonconformists and troublemakers. You are here this morning to honor a dead troublemaker. A man who failed to avoid revolution and got himself crucified. But it's all right now, because he's safely out of sight and we can interpret his words any way we like, or simply ignore them if they make us too uncomfortable. We can rationalize his life and idealize it until we're not only at ease with it, but even disposed to adore it. Safely. And of course we like to be safe. It's a wise and good thing to want to be safe, unless you make a god of it. And there is nothing more compelling in your life than safety, in which case the gospel by which you live will read like this: you won't skid if you stay in a rut. I found out one day on this recent trip that some teenagers really do not understand what a rut is. They have driven only on concrete and asphalt. They can't imagine a rut so deep in the clay that it becomes a kind of prison for your vehicle. And you go where the rut tells you to go. So I told them about driving with my father in a Model T Ford on country roads in ruts a foot deep, and how we were actually glad to get into them in the slick clay because they kept us from skidding off the road. My dad could have said to me truthfully, you won't skid if you stay in a rut. But I like to think He wouldn't have said that to me about the roadways of the mind and spirit where a rut is a grave with the ends knocked out. I should acknowledge, by the way, that I find conforming slavishly to non-conformity not much better. I mean, I'm always around some students who are different only for the sake of being different. Exhibitionists who only want to attract attention and have no other reason for marching to the sound of a different drum. People who echo, it seems to me, the motive of a very minor poet named Samuel Rogers. When he was asked why he said so many disagreeable things, he explained that he had a weak voice and that unless he said something nasty, nobody would listen to him. So he was a nonconformist, but not out of strength. And there are always a few people who run counter to the crowd, not out of some significant conviction, but to hide a weakness or a defect. But in the end, we suffer more from conformity, from giving in to the pressure to think and act like everybody else. Everybody in Rome would be making fun of Paul's new Christian friends and in some ways ridicule is much worse than persecution. Persecution can increase your self-respect. Ridicule can make you doubt yourself until you decide finally to be whatever it is your world says you should be. But the truth always is that no one respects you ultimately unless you are your own person. Henry Van Dyke put it well, you may have to live in a crowd, but you do not have to live like it or subsist on its food. You can have your own orchard. You can drink at a hidden spring. Paul knew what that hidden spring was, and so do you.